Please welcome the panel on Global Investment Outlook, The Big Picture, moderated by Global Head of Citi Private Bank, Ida Lu.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I'm Ida Lu, and I'm delighted to be joined by our panelists this afternoon. We have Todd Lemkin, CIO for Canyon. We have Rebecca Patterson, the Chief Investment Strategist for Bridgewater. We have over here Todd Jablonski, who is the Chief Investment Officer for Principal. And we have Brian Whalen, the co-CIO for TCW. So welcome, everyone, on the panel. So let's dive in right away on global investment opportunities. Let's start with the basics. What are investors doing today? Where are you seeing the flows, the opportunities? Where are they investing? Let's start with you, Todd.
I'm going to steal Brian's line because I'm first. They're definitely leaving credit, definitely leaving fixed income. As everybody's probably well aware, IG is down 16% now on the year. High yield about 9%. You've seen outflows from high yield and IG, 25 and 30, 45 billion from IG. So they're clearly leaving. I do think, though, our clients are inquiring about where they should go. They want to come out of generic conventional high yield or IG fixed income product, come out of duration, and look for something in alternative credit, which is, kind of poetic justice to us after spending years and years defending, the merits of what we do, avoiding duration and focusing on floating rate in special situations. So I think there is interest in finding something in that other 40%, a place to hide, so to speak, that seems defensive and perhaps can take advantage of the what seems ensuing volatility. We're cautiously optimistic. I think funds are going to start flowing into alternative credit, into distressed, and it does seem that there's a little bit of a changing of the guard going on right now.
Wonderful. Rebecca, are you seeing the same?
I think probably two things I'd highlight that we're seeing. One from our client base is more and more inquiries about how to protect the downside on their portfolios, which over the last decade have gotten more equity-centric and especially more private equity-centric. So you're losing some room to maneuver. So if bonds aren't going to give me the same diversification protection they did over the last few decades, what else can I own? So talking about a lot of defensive strategies, that's probably the biggest conversation, the most frequent conversation we're having. And then I think in terms of the opportunities we're seeing, at the heart of it, since our inception, we've been deeply fundamental researchers. We're really a research organization. And the research we do manifests itself in signals that we get that tell us how economic conditions are panning out. And when we look at those signals today that really, again, are tied very closely to the research we do, we're seeing the biggest mispricings in the market today that we've seen in a decade. So while the cause of a lot of those mispricings is really sad and unfortunate, at the end of the day, for investors who are looking at active management at alpha, it's actually a great environment.
To continue some of the thoughts around where we're having positive flows, I'd point to two areas where I think it's pretty clear that investors have a healthy appetite for some strategies. One, I'd point to retirement. Even though we're having, I think, some change in the markets and some change in how people perceive the economic landscape, retirees still need to save. And that's true all over the world, and it's true in target date in particular, where we've seen robust flows as retirees continue to contribute. But I'd also point out to diversified real assets. Whether that's commodities, real estate, infrastructure, natural resources, this is an area of the market that's picked up a great deal of interest as its headline inflation is now at a four-decade high. So I think that momentum continues, and some of the institutional interest in those diversified real assets, I think, are representative of, I think, what's a suitable tactical positioning in this macro market.
Perfect. We're going to dive in a little bit more later on that. Brian?
Yeah, Todd, thank you for not leaving me alone to defend the $50 trillion asset class. I appreciate it. For the first time in 30 years, which for probably at least half, maybe most of investors out there in their investing lifetime, the low-risk asset class is actually the underperformer in a down market. And I think that's kind of hard to embrace. And certainly we're fielding a lot of clients about where interest rates are going to go, when's it going to stop. Unfortunately, from your bond manager here, we don't know the answer to that. But what we would say is that the move has been so violent, it's been so quick, that while rates may not look cheap, it, finally in the bond market, you're starting to see some symmetry with regards to kind of the risk-reward, you know, balance. You know, it's kind of hard to make a case for bonds when the U.S. 10-year is at 1%, and you've got quantitative easing and suppressing credit spreads, and it's kind of hard to make an upside case for it. But, you know, at 3%, it's not to say interest rates, both nominal and real, can't go higher from here. But finally, you can probably make a kind of a strong fundamental argument that rates could go a little higher, or it could go, you know, a little bit lower. And so, you know, when it comes to our portfolios, we're seeing that balance. And yeah, generally speaking, you know, with a minus 10% return in bonds on the first quarter, and after a down 1.5% last year, investors are a bit nervous, and we're seeing some outflows. But we also are seeing not just outflows, but maybe shifts in the bond market. You know, where we're seeing investors think about opportunities, and we would support that, is moving away from some of your kind of traditional core plus fixed income that has 6-7 years of interest rate duration, but moving into areas like unconstrained or we call them income funds, which are more kind of LIBOR, SOFR based funds with a plus target. So you're basically not getting the interest rate risk, but you're giving an active fixed income manager the ability to kind of move those levers in the credit markets, whether to be IG or leverage finance, and also in the securitized market, to try to generate some healthy returns.
Nice. Rebecca, we've had a 10-year bull market, mm-hmm. and now we're seeing a lot of extraordinary volatility. It's a very uncertain time. You were talking just now in your opening comments about how there's this mispricing and this unique opportunity in the market. So where specifically are you looking at those opportunities, and how are you hedging some of the downside risk?
I think one of the most interesting things right now going on is that if you look at market pricing, it's expected that the world goes back more or less to pre-pandemic conditions pretty quickly. So inflation in the United States, for example, not going exactly to 2, but close to 2 within a year and a half, 2 years, and that happening with only moderate Fed tightening to get there. And when we look at that set of outcomes, the math just doesn't add up for us. So we think either one of two things or some combination will happen. Either the Fed will have to tighten more than is currently discounted to get inflation to target in a reasonable time frame, or it will have to acquiesce and accept inflation that's higher and stickier for longer. And we don't know exactly how much of each we're going to get, so we're positioning for both. So the opportunity we're trying to position for is higher inflation than what's priced. And so we're doing that, to your earlier point, through a number of inflation-sensitive assets, whether we're talking about a diversified basket of commodities, producers of commodities, those currency markets, something like the Canadian dollar or the Norwegian crown. And then on the other side, if the Fed could tighten more than expected, we've been positioning for higher rates along the curve for the last almost year now, but increasingly more on the long end. And also find some differential opportunities between markets, as those conditions differ a lot between countries.
So on that note, let me turn to you, Todd. Fed is expected to raise rates 50 basis points on Wednesday, followed consecutively by another 50 basis points rate hike, and then potentially 5 more. So tell us, what is your thought around the pace, the velocity? I mean, because right now, the number one thing on everyone's mind is recession. So tell us what your views are on that.
Well, I think recession's a natural sort of place for people to be concerned when we're in the midst of stagflation, right? We had a negative GDP print in the U.S., and we just hit a record in the last 4 decades in terms of inflation. So that, to me, suggests stagflation. You know, I think the Fed's going to come out with the 50 bip tightening. I wouldn't be surprised to see more quantitative tightening. But let's sort of take stock of what we have here. The Fed was slow to respond. Remember, at the beginning of the year, we were all sitting here, and the expectations were for 3 or 4 tightenings this year. Remember that? It was about 3 months ago. Right now, as of May 1st, the market's expecting 10 tightenings, which would put the rate at about 2.9%, which is actually a little north of what we think sort of the neutral rate is. So it's quite possible you're at restrictive policy maybe by the end of 2022, and you could see more restrictive policy take place in 23. I think ultimately, the Fed's trying to engineer a splashless dive from an increasingly high platform as our economy and the U.S. market increases its degree of difficulty. Yeah. We expect that you're going to continue to see tightening through maybe late 2022, early 2023. And the key issue is going to be, can that dive be landed in an environment where we don't want to end the decade-long expansion, But at the same time, you have the stagflation risk that's news to so many investors. I think fundamentally, the Fed has got to reestablish price stability. That's what's key, I think, for sort of the credibility of the Fed and what they're designed to do. So to establish price stability, that means the quick, aggressive removal of excess demand. That comes from tightening, and that excess demand, I think, responds when you see, I think, the Fed essentially take action quickly to avoid cash running into the industries already oversaturated with monetary stimulus.
Well, Todd, let's just hope that we do get that gold medal dive, and it is splashless. Brian, you mentioned earlier, you know, challenges in the fixed income market, lots of outflows. But in our view, bonds are back, right? When you look at intermediate muni yields of 3%, taxable equivalent yields of almost 6%, it is becoming appealing, and we are seeing flows back into municipals, for an example. So could you share with us what the opportunities that you're seeing, particularly in the fixed income market?
Sure. Well, first of all, I appreciate the optimistic outlook, so thank you for that. You know, for us, I talked about interest rates already. They look fair, you know, and hence you'll kind of see that in our positioning. I think kind of the first and foremost, what I'd say is, you know, we're kind of back to our 2019 playbook in terms of we're getting defensive, et cetera. But, you know, the first step we typically, and bond investors typically move into when you start to see opportunities, you play it safe. We call it safe spread. And you can look no further than the second largest fixed income asset class in the world, which is agency mortgages. You know, it's large, it's liquid, and it's undergone really two points of pressure. And the first one, obviously, is interest rate moves. And I think, we don't have to get too much into the bond geek language, but we all know, you know, mortgage-backed securities, particularly the ones guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae, the principal risk is that negative convexity. It's basically, you think you're going to get cash flows that come here in time, and then they can shift here when refinancing picks up, and then it can shift way out into the future when interest rates go up. And right now, less than 2% of mortgages in the United States are refinanceable. And so basically what's happened in pricing, the market's been efficient about it. It's basically taking this kind of this $6 to $7 trillion asset class and priced it all the way to extension. And so what's happened is you've the least amount of negative convexity in the agency mortgage market that you've ever had. However, that second pressure on the market comes down to QT. You know, it's what is about to happen, at least what's going to be announced on Wednesday. It's the Fed's going to kind of let us all know how they're going to start the process of reducing their balance sheet by about $3 trillion and pulling those reserves out of the system. And one of the, you know, the main components of that balance sheet is agency mortgages. And so the market's also embedded kind of this oversupply from the Fed just not stopping buying agency mortgages, but most likely, and we agree with it, in 2023, most likely starting to actually sell it. And so agency mortgage today, and they are effectively a credit, there's no effective credit risk, you know, embedded in it. You've got a fully extended asset class that's now trading at a spread that's much closer to a March 2020, summer of 2011 Eurozone crisis, or a great financial crisis type of spread because of that concern about what's to come over the next couple of years. So for us, that's kind of a natural first step for us to start to add in risk, add in some opportunities into a bond portfolio, you know, and agreeing, you know, down here with our colleagues from Bridgewater, which is, you know, given what's embedded in pricing, 300 basis points of hiking, you know, a quantitative tightening. At the same time, we may not get into this too much. We have this kind of this fiscal outflow, removal of the fiscal stimulus from the system. We have this kind of super tight effect on the economy, on markets, and our thought processes, and consistent here, which is, for us, it's hard to imagine, or at least we see a very low probability that you have that kind of cross currents of effect without things breaking. And when we talk about things breaking at TCW, we talk about leverage finance, we talk about down capital structure securitized. And so the opportunities today for us are high quality, like agency mortgages, maybe a little bit of interest rate duration, but the opportunity is also keeping your powder dry for a different environment when those asset classes are much cheaper.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you. Todd, this morning when we had our opening session here at Milken on global capital markets outlook, Jane Fraser, our CEO of Citi, said we probably need another S in the ESG, and that is around safety. Right, safety of information, think about cyber, safety of food, when you think about the issues around food security, safety around energy, you know, the ability to access energy in an efficient way. So as you think about all of these geopolitical risks and factors that are occurring around the world, what are your views and how are you positioning in light of all of this?
I mean, I think it goes back a little bit to this debate that we're expressing here about, you know, sort of Fed versus the inflation. Where are we really going to land on inflation and therefore where rates really have to go? Is the Fed doing a great job owning here as it kind of buys time for some of these deflationary forces? And I would put geopolitical on that list, as Kathy Woods and some others were saying earlier this morning. I thought that was a great panel. Many of the factors that were there in 2019 are still very much alive and well, and I think there is this narrative that is increasingly becoming dominant, as you can feel at this conference, around, you know, we're going to have this kind of late 70s inflation environment, and we don't really see that. I mean, obviously, we don't want to completely expose ourselves to that bet, and we wouldn't, and it isn't really our business to make that sort of macro call, but we'd sort of take the other side of that, and I think that the geopolitical forces of the day, as someone said earlier, you know, China and Europe look like they're almost in a recession, as they, Europe really has looked like it's been in a recession now for years, in my opinion. But China seems to be, you know, somewhat teetering in that direction as well. When you add that into, you know, some of the other demographic dynamics, sort of socialist political dynamics in the Western world especially, you know, I don't think the Fed, and we don't think the Fed is as far off or as far behind as people say they are. We actually think that at some point here, it does boil down to return of labor to the workforce. A lot of the supply chain logistical disruption that's caused a lot of this inflation, you know, at some simple level can be fixed over time. It's about time, I think, more than anything else. And I do think that's where the Fed has it right. So long-winded way of saying, I think the geopolitical dynamics today actually fit well into that deflationary counterbalance to this inflation-crazed narrative that everybody seems to be embracing, you know, a little too much so, perhaps.
Great. And I'm going to dive into some of those geopolitical risks with the panelists shortly as well. But before I do that, I just want to switch gears for a moment, Rebecca, to you.
Because I want to debate that.
Go ahead, please. By all means, let's debate it now, and then we'll go. We'll switch gears later.
Yeah, no, I mean,
that question was not on the script, by the way.
No, it wasn't on the script at all, but I feel compelled.
Go ahead.
I'm going rogue. Here we go.
Wait, there was a script?
You didn't get it? Oh, okay, sorry. We don't script. No, I think it's an interesting comment on demographics, which clearly over the long term is deflationary. I think one could argue how much of that is already known and discounted or not. But when I look at the geopolitics today, I would suggest that they're much more inflationary than deflationary, or maybe stagflationary. I mean, Russia-Ukraine is a supply shock. That's happening after we already had a demand shock. And the demand shock was caused by the policy response to the pandemic, which left households and businesses wealthier with higher savings, with more ability to spend, and they went out and spent. And we didn't have enough capacity to meet the demand in houses, in labor, in inventories, in commodities. And now Russia, Ukraine on top of that, which is mainly a commodity supply shock, is exacerbating that inflation pressure that already existed before Russia, Ukraine. And to fix that isn't something, I agree with you, it's time, but I think there's a lot more time needed than maybe most people appreciate. You can't suddenly get natural gas to Europe from the United States without first building gasification and degasification plants, rerouting pipes. These are things that are going to take years, not months or quarters. The labor supply in the U.S., yes, we're getting some labor supply back, but we still have 50% of companies, based on the latest surveys, 50% of companies in America can't find the labor they need. They have to resolve that with higher wages. Housing supply, our inventories today are at the lowest they've been in decades, and you can't get the materials or the labor to build them quickly. That's going to take years. And in the interim, as mortgage rates go up, you can't buy, so you rent, so the rents go up. And the supply chains, I agree, they will sort out with time, but China's COVID situation prolongs that period. So I agree, it's a matter of time, but when I look at that timing and I take the biggest, stickiest components of inflation in the United States today, I think those things are going to be with us, again, longer than people appreciate, longer than what's currently discounted in the market. So I look at the geopolitical risk at the margin as more inflationary than deflationary, at least over the next several quarters.
And Rebecca, U.S. dollar has been a beneficiary during this time. What are your views on the U.S. currency going forward and FX in general, the global foreign exchange opportunities that you're seeing?
All right. Well, Ida knows that I'm a currency geek. I started my banking career in currencies, and that is where my heart is. At the end of the day, currencies are all about capital account and current account, trade flows and capital flows. What's so interesting about the dollar right now is our external financing need is the greatest it's been in decades. Because of this demand shock and the inability of us to be able to meet that, we have to import more. Our net imports in the United States today are 50% above where they were pre-pandemic. And so we're selling dollars to get those goods brought in. So that means we need to get offsetting capital inflows just to keep the dollar steady. Now, so far, we have gotten those flows, in part because of more attractive yields as the Fed raises rates and bond yields go up, which we think they'll continue to do for a while. Sorry, I don't think bonds are back. Not yet. They'll come back eventually. But the vulnerability of the dollar that we're watching is that capital flow. You know, over the last decade, global diversification didn't get you much. You were better off just being in the U.S., right? The U.S. outperformed almost every year. But now, when we look at foreign exposure to U.S. equities, it's near the highest level it's been at since the mid-'80s. And so with that financing need getting bigger, if we don't see foreign investors continue to put not just the same amount, but more money in, the dollar's going to be vulnerable. Right now, we're net modestly long dollar, primarily against lower-yielding currencies, countries where the policymakers aren't raising rates as aggressively, things like the Japanese yen and the euro. But we're actually short dollars against a number of currencies, again, particularly those commodity exporters or countries that are tightening even faster than the U.S.
Great. And on that note, Todd, I'm going to switch over to you because Rebecca said something in her prior comments that was really interesting, and that is the increase in consumer demand, but yet the inability for our supply chain to provide all the goods, you know, particularly around automobiles. We heard some comments from Mary Barra about the inability to get all the supplies and the parts to manufacture the automobiles. Likewise, we're having similar pressures in the semiconductor industry, for example. So where does this sort of level out, right? The ability to come back, the supply chain, and also the consumer demand leveling out to a place that you think is going to be more normal?
Well, I think the key to maybe solving some of these supply chain questions is really finally getting no new surprises on the horizon, right? When we were at the beginning of this, remember the word transitory inflation? I used the word transitory inflation, so did Chairman Powell and many others, because it seemed like it was a relatively short-lived phenomenon, right? There were elements of this that seemed like they could pass with some ease as you saw the Fed take action and as investors digested where we were from an inflation standpoint. What actually happened, however, is that you had the Ukraine crisis, as Rebecca mentioned, that increasingly disrupted the delivery of natural resources and global trade. You throw in the lockdowns in China, it means that these supply chains can last longer. If there's one upside of all this, or if there's one upshot that I think is rather interesting, I think it's around global logistics. Mm-hmm. And people talk a lot about onshoring as being the solution for this, like in a world where perhaps, again, you could see additional outbreaks in other areas that would require some restrictions. But really, I just want to focus on what that means essentially in terms of delivering a revolution in logistics. You've seen it happen before, and companies, countries, and individuals will find ways to get the goods and services that they're looking for. And even if it requires a huge premium, I expect that the engineers and the logistical operators around the world will be working very hard to find ways to ensure that next time you want to buy something like a car, it's there for you. Every time one of those issues happens where you've got a purchase ready to be made but the supply can't happen, some corporation somewhere is recognizing that and they're taking steps to make sure it doesn't happen again in the future. So I'd actually suggest that maybe about 2023 you'd see some moderation of where we see the pressures today. But in the intermediate term, I expect a little bit of an evolution, if not a revolution, in terms of how companies find their suppliers and how those supply elements meet the final production.
Okay, so by the end of this year?
I think by the end of this year, you start to see inflation probably level off. I'd say you might see a 5% inflation print by the end of 2022, but we expect that to continue to moderate maybe into 2023, closer to 4% as year-over-year comps, I think, start to make that a little easier.
Okay, and Brian, on Russia-Ukraine, obviously, with Russia being the top exporter of fertilizer, mm-hmm. we've got issues around global food supply chain concerns there, and then also with wheat and corn, you know, being produced both in Russia and the Ukraine. What are you looking at, and how are you thinking about the broader implications to the rest of the world with what's happening in this one particular region?
Sure. I'll answer that, but I still kind of want to get back to Rebecca here, because she's got me thinking on interest rates. I think that's where we should kind of direct the conversation. But, you know, on Russia-Ukraine, the honest answer is we don't know. I have no insight as to, you know, how this thing is going to play out. But, what you know, I think we can all agree on is it's stagflationary. Obviously, it's, you know, there's an economic hit, particularly to the Eurozone. It only kind of magnifies or amplifies the inflationary trends that were already in place, you know, as we came into this year. So you just kind of take these issues of supply chain and just, you kind of magnified the issue. But tying the war, there's elements of it that we think can't be undone, and that's the inflationary aspect of that, you know, in supply chains and, you know, whether it's precious metals or food and things like that. As we think about it, as it kind of translates back to U.S. inflation and U.S. interest rates, what we think will be interesting is that we kind of, as we move along and we get into the second half of this year, what we may start to see is a divergence in trends of inflation, meaning that, you know, for the 2021 headline and core inflation basically moved in the same direction. You know, we kind of finished the year. They're about 200 basis points apart, you know, with regards to headline and core, but nonetheless, we're kind of moving in the same direction. We could see later this year, because of the war, you could see headline inflation kind of really supported by food and energy kind of stay relatively sticky up in that kind of upper single digit type of level. But because of the demand destruction that the Fed primarily is instituting into the economy, you could see core inflation start to come back down. And we think that introduces, it's an interesting conversation in that it certainly raises the possibility of a policy error, meaning that maybe the Fed monetary policy, both in the U.S. as well as kind of, you know, other large, you know, developed central banks may be focused more on that headline, as they've clearly changed the priorities in terms of what they're focusing on. I mean, we saw it in Powell. It came out really last November. He stood in front of Congress, or sat in front of Congress, and he said to the world, you know, that put everybody knows, you know, you love on your asset classes like equities and stuff. Well, the strike just got a lot lower, and kind of waved his arms and said that. And as we came into the issue, that was one of the reasons we kind of moved to such a defensive playbook. It was like the Fed's changed its priority scale, and they've taken inflation from somewhere down here that they didn't really have to worry about because of the secular tailwinds that have kept it so low for 3 to 4 decades, and now they've moved it up here. And so as they embark on this, I don't know if it's 12 hikes, 13 hikes, maybe it's 15 hikes, as I think probably Rebecca or more, you know, might lead you to believe. Nonetheless, it leads to potential error down the line and a further reason to be cautious. And one more point I just want to get in is, as we kind of think about what's, I think, most investors at the end of the day typically hang their hat on, at least now, which comes down to the U.S. consumer and the strength we've seen in the U.S. consumer. And certainly, the U.S. consumer's desire to spend money on goods has been unprecedented. Somewhat of a work on their own and somewhat kind of, you know, infusion coming from fiscal policy from the pandemic. But, you know, It's an interesting time in that we're emerging from Omicron. You know, we're getting into the warmer months, and we're seeing a shift from consumers wanting to spend money on goods to wanting to spend money on experiences. And I think that, at least right now in this current environment, in our opinion, makes the consumer look a little healthier than we might see as we get into the fall. Meaning that, you know, this rise in, you know, mortgage rates from 3% to 5%. You know, we're going to see rises in auto payments. We're on the edges of the goods. We're starting to see consumers, you know, kind of through our work in the asset-backed market, you know, the consumer receivables market, we're starting to see them start to shift their preferences from kind of the higher quality goods to maybe substituting, you know, less expensive goods. So there are signs there that while the consumer is probably a good bet, you know, if you're lending to them, they may not be a good bet if you're kind of hanging from a growth perspective. I mean, they have the ability to service their debt. Right now, we're starting to question their willingness to spend on a go-forward basis once this hiking has kind of taken place.
Yeah. Can I jump in on Absolutely. Some of your comments, too, around the consumer? Because that is an area where we've seen some strength, right? Consumer spending has held up pretty well. And across this panel, I think I've heard, you know, a fair bit of caution and a fair bit of sort of leaning into defensive positionings. But I'd encourage, you know, the audience and others to not get too defensive too quickly, right? Some of the higher frequency data comes out on the consumer, from payrolls for how they're spending to U.S. corporate earnings. We're in the first quarter, we actually did better than most analysts expected, more beats than misses. Now, this year is what, 7% global earnings growth is a shadow of what, the 46% that we had last year on a COVID stimulus. But that's part of the reason why valuations have already come down. And today, our research is pretty clearly indicating you can't expect valuation increases to drive returns. So if those aren't driving returns, what could? Well, fundamental improvement. And I think the corporate earnings outlook, while not robust and certainly below where we had it in previous years, there are reasons to be optimistic about risk assets. And today, again, I mentioned global natural resources, commodities, some of the other elements around a diversified real asset sort of strategy. Those are up in risk items. Mm-hmm. Those add to your standard deviation as investors. And I still think the environment today can reward the right kind of risk seeking, particularly where you get exposure to inflation sensitive assets and the U.S. consumer, where I agree you're seeing some healthy, I think, numbers from that cohort.
And I loved your point earlier, too. You're absolutely correct. In the first quarter, corporate earnings beat expectations 80% of the time. So healthy, still there. You're absolutely right. We're seeing very high savings rates, very high consumption behavior on the banking side as well. So very interesting points. So thank you for sharing that. I'm going to switch gears over here to you. And we've just talked about Russia, obviously. And now we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk a bit about China. Mm-hmm. So what are you thinking? Are the risks associated with investing in the region factored in at this moment, the China risk, fully? Do you think China's going to hit the 5% growth target for the end of the year? Give us your views on what your thoughts are with that region.
Sure. I mean, again, we don't spend the kind of time I think Rebecca probably does on analyzing China. But, we find China's, particularly the real estate crisis of late there, has been fascinating. We're a little involved in Evergrande bonds and some of the other property development companies there. China feels to us, we've had an office in Hong Kong for years now and marketing offices there forever, is like it's really lost its way. Again, with the caveat that we're far from experts. We are not rushing in to invest in China. I think there are some really interesting knock-on effects, sort of the collateral damage from what the change in policy, and particularly the real estate market, is doing to other parts of the world. You've got Chinese developers or Hong Kong developers that own properties in the UK that we've been investing in that we think are pretty interesting. Some different stress financing opportunities that are kind of being spit out of these developers as they're scrambling to meet margin calls and raise collateral, raise cash from collateral. But generally speaking, it feels like something like Evergrande is in the first, second, third inning. They've got a long way to go. There's just absolutely no jurisdictional precedent there whatsoever for dealing with bankruptcy or dealing with creditors. Maybe a little bit like what you saw in Dubai years ago, but on a much grander scale. So we're very cautious about it. I think COVID there gets better. I think they appreciate it has to, but I'm not saying anything profound in saying that. But we're not certainly rushing in there, to go buy up a bunch of Chinese real estate debt or other corporate debt in China.
Rebecca, do you agree with Todd on views on China?
Not really. But that's what makes the market. This is what you want on a panel. If we all agreed, you could just talk to one of us and be done. I do agree completely with the scale of challenges that China's facing, right? They have taken a different approach to COVID, in part because a lot of their elderly population is less vaccinated. It's not clear the efficacy of their vaccines overall. Their healthcare system is very different than many countries in the West, so they've taken this zero approach, and that means very stringent lockdowns. The Shanghai cases seem to be getting better, but there's other provinces where cases are ticking up, including Beijing. Right now, we estimate about the provinces locked down reflect about 20% of GDP. That's a huge number, even if it's tactical. At the same time, you made the point on the economy and what's going on with the property market. They've taken a very intentional decision to try to reduce leverage in their property market. They're trying to move from a boom-bust cycle to longer-term high-quality growth and one where houses are not the same source of speculation they've been in the past. But that is a painful process. Totally agree with that. And at the same time, they have this growth target in what's a very important political year for President Xi Jinping. And will they hit the 5.5%? We'll see. They are increasingly getting vocal about the need to do more stimulus. And they are announcing more stimulus, but it's still unclear to us if it'll be sufficient to get to that target. And even if they announce it, does it flow through? Or is it pushing on a string? Now, that's the economy, but as we all know, there can be very big differences between what happens in an economy and what happens in markets. And what we've found is having a balanced set of Chinese stocks and bonds, so taking what we call an all-weather approach to China, has gotten us positive year-to-date results. So obviously, Chinese equities have had a very difficult start to the year, but because their central bank is in a very different place and they're easing monetarily, bond yields are getting us a positive return. And when we put those two things together, we're getting good geographic diversification from China and we're making money. So I think it's important to understand what's happening economically, of course, and understand those risks and position accordingly. But it's also important not to lose sight of the fact that markets and economies affect each other, but they're not always twins.
What about specific industries? So pivoting away now from China for a moment, what about specific industries where you see opportunity? Like for us, I'm thinking healthcare with all of the...
You mean in China or globally?
Globally. Globally. Industry segments like AI, like cyber, telemedicine. Tell me what you're viewing as really interesting industry picks for folks that are looking at opportunities.
Sure. So I fear this is going to get a little bit dark, but one thing that we've done a lot of work on over the last few years is understanding targeted fiscal stimulus. You know, obviously in the pandemic, the policy response was different than what we've seen before. Instead of monetary being the main lever to try to support growth, fiscal was the dominant lever, and it was facilitated by monetary policy. And we saw a lot more direct investment by the government, both in businesses and households, including some legislation that would put money directly into certain types of sectors, to your point. So one piece of research we did was try to understand how quickly does this get priced in? You know, if President Biden is saying, I want to spend X dollars on X industry, well, did you just miss the trade? Is it already discounted? And what we found going back several decades and looking across many different countries as examples is that while some of that gets priced in initially, because of the nature of the capital flows that come from the government into these companies tied to the sector, you tend to see those sectors outperforming the rest of the market for 2, 3, 5 years because of the nature of how the capital is allocated to those companies from the government. So when I think about the world we're in today, you know, we heard Treasury Secretary Yellen talk about friend-shoring recently. Mm. In the IMF meetings, we heard about, you know, what I call now allocations with allies. And I think we are going to see more government money being put to certain sectors to help make, to your point earlier on supply chains, to make us more resilient. Not necessarily lowest cost, it's inflationary, but you're looking at strategic industries tied to healthcare, for example, or biotech. To the degree you see that government money allocated, my takeaway to you would be don't assume it's fully priced just because it became public news. What we've seen consistently over history is that these things tend to have legs and provide good investment opportunities for the medium term as well.
Todd, your thoughts on that?
Well, government spending, you know, can be sort of a fickle animal, right? Sometimes it works in your favor, sometimes it works against you, and often the, you know, capricious sort of decision-making of policymakers can really have impacts on markets in ways that I think are interesting, but often unpredictable. As we think about sort of sectors and parts of the economy where I think I do see intermediate to long-term strength, I go back to big cap tech. Big cap tech, it got creamed in the first quarter of this year. It has been creamed as investors are now discounting the future earnings at a new rate. But I highly doubt that in the halls of sort of the FAMANG stocks, they're deeply, deeply concerned about the movement in 10-year rates. Their business models are unaffected. The move towards cloud computing, social media, all the elements that drive actually pretty decent valuations now in cash flows on a cash flow basis, makes me think that that group could, in fact, make a bit of a rebound and I think surprise some investors in terms of what it can do. I'd also point out that in the other sectors, whether it's in industrial equipment, ag equipment, whether it's in financial services, Where do they spend their CapEx when they want to essentially grow their business? It's in technology. Every industry grows through technology. So knowing that that's the differentiator and knowing that CapEx and spending, I think at the corporate level, sustains a lot of what's happening on the consumer side in terms of a retreat, means that that cohort of mega cap tech giants can evolve past being a pure growth engine, and you start to see more dividends, more profitability, more regular recurring earnings. I think that's an underappreciated, inexpensive, liquid, highly successful cohort that perhaps is being, perhaps investors are not paying enough attention to anymore.
So may I ask you, what is your target outlook for growth? So as you're thinking about, okay, where are we going to be at the end of this year, have you made revisions to your outlook on growth and market opportunities?
I think we revised down, just as everyone has. Again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the year, most people were expecting 3 to 4 tightenings of 25 bips. We're up now at 10 being the base expectation, perhaps more. Certainly, we've rounded down expectations in terms of overall growth, but I don't know that that's the cohort that necessarily is behind it. Again, I think technology is going to continue to be a driver of growth globally, and if anything, I really want to see how it evolves outside of the U.S. For so long, technology has been such a U.S.-dominated industry. We had some titans in Asia, but then they recently corrected under sort of the Common Prosperity Program. But you take those efforts and you look at sort of where growth can be, I do expect corporate earnings to be at 7%. Mm-hmm. I do think that you could get to positive real GDP growth of north of 2-3%. Yep. You put those elements together, that is an environment where risk assets can deliver a positive return maybe over the next 6 to 12 months. Mm-hmm. I'd encourage investors not to retreat too quickly again when there's opportunity and I think value on the table.
Perfect. So, Brian, I'm going to go down the panelists here. I want you all to share the key takeaways of what you want all investors to be thinking about, where the opportunities are, what would your recommendations be, where should they be focused?
Yeah, let's keep it, we'll build off the risk asset comment. You know, I think entry point's everything, you know, particularly in the bond market. You know, I mentioned it, just ask yourself, you know, is 375 off on high yield bonds from a spread perspective, does that sound more backward looking or more forward looking? I think we would argue with, you know, it's the former. It seems like the market is still kind of looking back at kind of historical growth rates, ability to service debt, et cetera. It just doesn't feel like it's kind of pricing in the order of magnitude of this adjustment in monetary policy we're about to see. So in terms of opportunities, we're talking about agency mortgages. I won't bore you to death on that again. You know, the next step, talk about high yield. And, you know, actually in agency mortgages, I use the word convexity. And I talked about, you know, as interest rates shift, there is a type of convexity in leverage finance, you know, and I think I've clearly, we're not a fan of leverage finance right now on an outright basis. We think there'll be cheaper, you know, entry points, but you can use the rate rise to your advantage right now, meaning that we've had such an aggressive rate of 200 basis point sell-off. You're derating those cash flows, not just on treasury bonds, but on high yield bonds with a much higher interest rate, which means the price you can buy some of these bonds at today is in the 60s or 70s dollar price. And these are on money good, kind of solid, kind of cash flow generating companies. And what it creates, it's an idiosyncratic opportunity, but what it allows you to do is situationally look for situations where you can buy bonds at 60, 70 cents on the dollar, still get that 375 spread, but if you do your homework the right way, you can look for effectively corporate events, you know, whether it be LBO, change of control, clauses in the indentures and the credit agreements that effectively will buy you out at par. And so that's kind of how you can use the sell-off to your advantage to maybe make some money in the interim at kind of a bottoms-up-like level before you start kind of allocating dollars at the tops-down level, you know, when there might be, you know, better entry points. And maybe finally, and one more point, you know, we look a lot, and we're involved quite a bit on the securitized side. You know, we look at asset backs, we look at commercial mortgage-backed securities, we look at residential mortgage-backed securities, and I made some comments earlier about the consumer and cautious on the way they're going to spend, but you know, again, if you think about the consumer from as almost as a corporation, their ability to service their debt, you know, the financial obligation ratio of the consumer is incredibly strong. They have an incredible amount of home equity effectively built in there. So if we're right and, you know, things are going to break over the next 6 to 12 months and there's good entry points in credit, it will probably also come alongside something else we didn't talk about, which will probably take a whole nother hour, which is illiquidity. You know, the capital markets don't function like they used to. And when we hit these air pockets, good asset classes with strong fundamental value like non-residential credit, so, you know, the consumer credit on the mortgage side, they're going to get cheap. And you may be able to get an opportunity kind of in a systemic way, like buying the credit risk from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or you might be able to get some more interesting opportunities in kind of the jumbo market, non-conforming market. But make no mistake, they'll be there. They'll be priced to a more dire, macro environment. But again, just kind of remember the stability you have of the consumer going into that time period.
Great. Todd?
I think I'd point to maybe two areas where we currently have a positive tactical view, and then maybe one area where we're a bit negative, maybe to give some ideas. I think what I'd clearly indicate is that, one, mortgages are an area to look at.
There you go.
Pretty recently, we actually took a look in our balanced multi-asset strategies, and if you're looking at treasuries to serve as your risk-off vehicle, I'd encourage you to take a look at, again, agency mortgages, which have a lot of similar characteristics, and that negative convexity does, I think, portend some good entry points for mortgages down the line. At the same time, I'd point to diversified real assets, commodities, infrastructure, the kinds of, again, real asset direct ownership of situations where you have inflation-linked asset classes, but I would emphasize the diversification component. Picking off individual inflation-sensitive asset classes can be a dangerous timing game, but through a diversified basket, I think the ride can be smoothed a bit. I like both of those elements as being a long tactical positions for an 6 to 12 month horizon. On the downside, where I see some overvaluation is really in the REIT market. REITs have been one of the better performing sectors, and despite their strong relationship with real 10-year yields, that relationship fell apart in the first quarter of this year. And you saw REITs deliver, even as expected, real rates went the other way. So ultimately, I think what that portends for REITs is a readjustment in valuation. Quite possibly, REITs have achieved an unsustainable valuation. We are underweight REITs on a lot of those concerns and the relationship with real rates.
Great. Rebecca?
Sure. I think if there was one thing I'd love to leave you all with today, it's to understand that the pandemic, and probably to a degree Russia-Ukraine, has served as an inflection point, and we've moved into a new regime. And that catalyst wasn't the pandemic itself as much as the policy response, both the magnitude of the response, but also the details of the response. Again, primarily just this wall of money that went directly to households and corporates and left them in a stronger position coming out of the recession than when they went in it, which is not something you normally see, at least we've seen in the last several decades. And so what that means is today and looking forward, the things you've assumed for the last 30 years no longer hold true, or at a minimum are at a lot of risk of not holding true. So over the last 30 years, inflation was low and stable. It was changes in growth that drove changes in asset prices. Today, you need to flip that upside down. Inflation is going to be the more important variable. If we're right, core inflation is at 6% in 12 months' time. If we're wrong, it's still going to be the change in inflation that's going to be the bigger variable driving things. And tied to that, if inflation is the bigger variable, then having bonds as your diversifying asset in your portfolio might not get you the balance you need. So you need to think about, if we're in an inflation or stagflationary environment, how do I get balance? And then I'm going to agree with you that having diversified inflation-sensitive exposure, be it commodities or inflation-sensitive equities that'll benefit from that, there's a lot of ways to get there, is going to be a better source of balance today. And most investors don't have that yet. They're missing that and they're exposed. And then finally, over the last 30 years, because you've been in the secular declining interest rate environment, longer duration cash flows looked fabulous, and money has moved into the U.S., I think today you have to have more geographic diversification. You can't count on the U.S. being that sole engine of growth. I agree that the consumer in the U.S. today is fairly strong. We are looking for real GDP growth to stall out by the end of this year, but largely that's a function of inflation versus nominal growth, not necessarily the consumer retrenching. But I think we're in a position where you could have financial assets underperforming the real economy. And so if bonds aren't helping you, stocks aren't helping you, you need to be staring at your portfolios and thinking, where do I get balance? Where do I find safety? It might not be the same place it's been in recent decades. You need to go back further in time to think through the playbook.
I get to conclude, huh?
Well, you can disagree with me now.
I don't disagree with Rebecca on anything at all.
There you go.
No, I'm kidding. I would say, we like the setup. I mean, as you said, I think it's idiosyncratic. I think this is one of those rare moments we get. We had it for 2 minutes in 2020 and, you know, end of 2018, 2013, obviously 2008, when you actually get paid to rummage through what we keep referring to as the bond market or the bonds. You know, long-dated AAA mortgages at 130 spreads are interesting, but it's a duration bet, I think. You know, it's safe, the credit's fine, but at the end of the day, it's an interest rate call. On the other hand, you know, I think there are pockets now, you're seeing it. You know, triple C spreads are almost out at 800. I don't know where they are today, that's where they were last night. You know, yeah, the high yield index is at a 400 spread, but there are a lot of things in that high yield index that skew it, and the duration of the index isn't that long, et cetera. You don't know, is it really going to be the next big, massive recession, credit crisis? In some ways, we'd like it to be honest. We have a lot of dry powder for that sort of thing. I think the problem is so does the rest of the world, at least from where we look. And I think a lot of this, what we're referring to as the leverage finance market, is sitting in private credit these days and in very resilient structures, if you're honest about it. I think that's part of what you saw in 2020 as well. You know, never say never, but we're not super confident, or I'd say we're skeptical, that you're really going to have this onslaught of massive sell-off in credit. I think this rotation out of duration, out of more generic fixed income, it can continue, and I think into the summer here, we'll see what the Fed says this week. There certainly could be a lot of, a lot of volatility, and there tends to be in the summer to begin with. But we gravitate to. It just doesn't feel like it's really going to come unhinged. We're sort of welcoming it if it actually does indeed, but it feels like more of an opportunity into the summer, and I think eventually. A little bit, as I've been saying, change in the narrative here. You can feel everybody's increasingly on this same page, you know, the ultra inflation page. Maybe right, but normally when everybody is crowded in the same part of the room, that does tend to be the wrong place to be. I kind of agree on, it's not our bailiwick at all, but I kind of agree on the FANG stocks. I mean, you can look at these stocks now, it's a cliche, but they're value stocks. I mean, they are cheap. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things they were doing, there's, you know, 6 months ago that everybody liked, they're still doing. I mean, it's sort of overdone, to say the least. I think if you look at hedge fund positioning, a great study was done recently on how low exposures are now to the tech sector as after being at all-time highs from all the name hedge funds in the equity space. You know, leverage levels aren't that high. The banks are healthy. The consumer is debatable, but I think relatively healthy. Unemployment, we can debate how you calculate unemployment, all those things, but unemployment is in a good place. So we see it more as an opportunity. We're guarding against the prospect of it being more than that, of course. But I don't think we subscribe to this narrative of it's really going off the cliff here. So anyway, that's where I would end.
Well, I think that our panelists have certainly given us all a lot to think about. A huge thank you to you, Todd, Rebecca, and Todd and Brian for joining us today and providing your very insightful commentary. I hope that everybody walks away with a lot of great takeaways from this conversation. And thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.